welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle. On today's show, we have Jim Pease from the Water Trails Program. And Jim is a former retired professor of Iowa State University and knows a lot about conservation and environmental issues around Iowa. So welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And Jesse Lowry is here as well. And Jesse, why don't you start off the show today and tell us a little bit about Blank Park Zoo and what we do to save animals in the wild.
Thanks, Ryan. Again, I'm Jesse Lowry, Director of Conservation and Research here at Blank Park Zoo. And I always like to start off the show by setting the stage and talking about what a modern zoo like Blank Park Zoo can do to help facilitate saving animals in the wild and helping our environment locally and internationally. The mission of Blank Park Zoo is to inspire an appreciation of the natural world through conservation, education, research, and recreation. And what I like to call it is a window to the wild, a place where we can invite the community to come through our gates and see the amazing agility of a sea lion or look into the eyes of a snow leopard and feel that sense of awe that we all feel when we see these amazing animals. But, you know, it's our job to turn that sense of awe into a behavior change, a conservation action, some kind of inspiration for these people to then try to help out what's happening in the world with animal populations. And, you know, with Blank Park Zoo, we do that in a multitude of ways. One easy way is by being green. We try to be as sustainable in our business practices as possible every day here at Blank Park Zoo. And that's something easy that everybody can do in their own lives and really has a direct connection to animals here in Iowa. We have lots of local projects here at the zoo, Plant Grow Fly, which is a pollinator conservation project, encouraging folks to plant butterfly gardens, whether it's a single pot or an entire prairie restoration. They all matter to butterflies and bees. We've got over 1,000 gardens now, so check out Blank Park Zoo's website to learn more. We have an upcycle program where we remove invasive plant species from local parks, like honeysuckle and mulberry, that's kind of taking over the woodlands. And it just so happens that that's a favorite treat item of the giraffe and rhino here at the zoo. So everybody wins. But, you know, the real backbone of what a zoo like Blank Park Zoo can do to help save animals is the support of the field organizations, those individuals and organizations that are out in the front lines in the range countries of where a lot of our animals, wild cousins are from. And so we give about $75,000 per year to In the Wild conservation. And we support everything from giraffe in Namibia to hornbills in Thailand, to snow leopards in Mongolia. And, you know, I'll cut to the chase. The only reason why we can do all these projects is because of the support of the community. Every single dollar that we make, a portion of that dollar goes to these projects, goes to save animals in the wild. So if you're coming on a Sunday afternoon, or you decide to get married at the zoo, or you come to our Zoo Brew events, you are saving animals in the wild. And so it's a pretty neat story to share with people. And this radio show has been awesome to really archive all of the stories here at Blank Park Zoo and to bring in some of our favorite partners that we've worked with throughout the years. And Jim Pease is I would say, a hero in Iowa. And he's a very humble man, but he's done so much over his life. We've had him here to advise us on many projects. He's been a speaker for our speaker series. And we've all learned so much from him over the years. And so it's great, again, Jim, to have you here and just welcome again.
Thank you, Jess. I appreciate it.
So, Jim, let's start out by please just giving us a little story about your background.
Oh, okay. Well, I grew up in southeastern Iowa as a youngster right on the Mississippi River down there and had a wonderful childhood, the childhood that I wish every child could have, because with the support of our parents, we spent countless hours not only hiking the hills and the valleys of hilly southeastern Iowa, but canoeing all the rivers. I canoed the Skunk and the Cedar and the Iowa and the Des Moines and, of course, the Mississippi as a kid. And, in fact, my brother and I bought our first used wooden canvas canoe when I was in seventh grade, again, with the support of our parents. They gave us, and I was really fortunate to be able to thank them before they both died for giving us that sort of freedom and trust that is so hard, I think, especially these days, for parents to give up. We hear all the stories of all child molestation and all this stuff. And I think parents get very afraid. So I felt very, very fortunate to have parents who weren't afraid, who said, you have to spread your wings. And in this case, it was our water wings, our wild wings, if you will. And we were able to spend a lot of time in the wild. From there, I went to Wisconsin for school, a bachelor's and master's at University of Wisconsin-Madison in wildlife, and became a naturalist, a frontline naturalist at a residential environmental education learning center and with the state 4-H program in Wisconsin. So I started their first program, and for a while, for the last several years, I was teaching 10,000 kids a year at a residential camp. So this is a really intense, wonderful position. Came back to Iowa in 1980 and worked with young people here in the 4-H program, the Natural Resources program, as well as adults, because I felt really strongly about the need to have a multiplier effect. So I worked with a lot of adults as well to train them both as purveyors of the wildness, as spokespeople, as leaders for getting people into to wild places and wild things, and then became a professor in an academic department where I taught lots and lots of, I started their interpretive program, so people who wanted to be naturalists with county, state, national parks, with Blank Park Zoo. I've had lots of former students work down here, and with museums, and that took my classes in interpretation, and so they're spread all over the place now, and it's really nice to see them doing wonderful things. So I retired a few years ago now, and have been since. Doing lots of consulting, and among those things, I've been working with the Iowa Rivers Revival in their Master River Steward program, and also with the Iowa DNR and the Water Trails program that they've started there. So I've been doing lots of paddling. So it's kind of like going back to my childhood again, except I paddled lots more miles than I think I even did as a kid. So.
This is one of my favorite parts of this radio show, is that I get to bring in all of our partners that we've worked with for so long and hear their stories again and hear their background. And Jim, I think that you're a wonderful example, just like you said, of parents allowing their kids to take risks and push boundaries as children in nature, and maybe fall down and skin your knee and maybe get caught out in a rainstorm.
Absolutely.
And that has turned you into the conservationist that you are today. And I agree that, you know, kids really need that connection with nature. And that's what we hear many times with the folks that we bring in for this radio show, that they started out with experiences like that as a kid. Yeah. And so we all know that that's really important to help facilitate that for kids today and get dirt underneath their fingernails and let them go out and play with mud.
My older brother and I we could kind of goad on our younger brother. He didn't have the fear of heights that my older brother and I sort of had a little bit of. And so we'd find a hawk's nest down in Geode State Park. And we'd say, well, gee, that one's so high, nobody could climb that. And of course, he'd be halfway up the tree already. So it was great. It was a wonderful childhood. We skinned a lot of knees, and I don't recall breaking a lot of bones, but got a lot of dirt under our fingernails. We built a pond one weekend when my folks were gone. My older brother was in high school, and I was still in junior high, I think. So we built a pond in our backyard, cemented it in, the whole thing, while they were gone. And they didn't get upset when they came home. They thought that was wonderful. Our backyard was for us to play in and do wonderful things. And I can see lots of other people today, in retrospect, saying, oh, my gosh, they ruined the yard and they dug this up. But no, they thought it was really good that we did that. And we caught turtles and put them in there for a while and some fish, until they, of course, ate all the fish. And then we realized, oh, yeah, a little something about food chains and food is pretty important to understand as a kid.
That was your first lesson in food change and aquatic ecosystems. Jim, let's talk about this Water Trails program that you've mentioned. And, you know, tell us about the program and how people can get involved.
Yeah, it's Iowa's rivers. We have thousands and thousands of miles of Iowa rivers and streams. And they are, from my standpoint, I think our most important single habitat that we have left in the state. Iowa is very much an agricultural state, not only in terms of the direct agriculture where crops are grown on the land, but all the industries that support that. So it's a very important industry in Iowa. But we've gotten to the point where agriculture, roads, cities, towns, housing developments have taken up so much land. There's very little left here in the state for wild things. Iowa was once mostly prairie, 85% tall grass prairie. 99.9% of that prairie is gone today. Particularly the north central region, including here into Polk County, as a gift from the last glacier, we had lots and lots and lots of, you know, thousands of wetlands that were there that would help process the water that came off the land and would clean that water before it went into our waterways. Between 95 and 98% of those wetlands were drained to create the society we have today. The same thing with our woodlands. And it's varied a little bit over the years, but something like 3/4 of our woodlands that were once here are no longer here. The rivers are the one thing on the landscape that haven't been, they've been altered. Just some of them have been channelized, and a few have been, you know, altered in other ways, but with dams and things like that. But we, they're really the ribbon on the landscape that allows critters to have these corridors of habitat. And without those corridors of habitat, we wouldn't have the rich, relatively rich wildlife that we have in the state today. The Water Trails Program seeks to get people out on our rivers. And people, of course, were doing that, but especially in the, I would say, the last decade, there's been this upsurge of interest. Kind of surprised me because I thought everybody was interested, you know, in rivers, because I always was. But the sales of canoes and kayaks and things like that have really, really gone up. And I think it's an example of the kinds of things that Iowans are expressing, saying, we need some of that wild experience again. So they're going back to the land, going back to the rivers. The Water Trails Program, the DNR, has sought to sort of unify and provide some funding for and some guidance for basically volunteer groups of paddlers that in different parts of the state have used the Middle River or the Upper Iowa or the Nishnabotna or the Des Moines as vehicles for recreation. So the Water Trails Program helps to get them funding. What I've been doing is for the Water Trails Program is I've been paddling Iowa rivers for the last 4 summers. Paddled over 1,800 miles of Iowa rivers, which has just been—it's been a gift to me. It's been so exciting to do that, to be able to do that, and literally rivers from coast to coast in Iowa, from the Missouri coast to the Mississippi coast, and north and south as well. Rivers all over the state, and I paddle them doing biological surveys and interpretive surveys, sort of point in time surveys of the animals I see. I GPS all the eagles' nests and other important places. Carry along a little digital recorder, record everything that I'm seeing along the way, including the vegetation as it changes along the river. Different trees grow in different locations. And then put together a long report together with about 150 to 250 photos each time of each segment of river that I do. And then they use that then to decide where a water trail that may already be designated or might not be designated will be or should be, and where the accesses could be along there if they can get agreement with both public and private landowners along the way. So it's been really exciting for me to be kind of in on the ground floor of this and being able to help them make the water trails more available to the public. We put out then brochures eventually that have interpretive information and very good maps for where the accesses are, where all the roads cross and where the bridges cross, that sort of thing, so that they can understand, people who use the rivers then can understand something about what it is they're paddling through.
You know, as you were talking about that, I wrote down in my notebook, connector. I feel like the rivers are the connector for the wildlife and all of the species that have been, you know, forced to the river's edge because of all the converted landscape, but the connector for people, the connector for people back to the land and to the water and to nature.
Yeah.
And so it's just an amazing story to hear that people are getting more interested in that, because that's just going to bode wonderful things for in the environmental movement in Iowa and the Midwest. And so people need access to the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
They probably need to be trained about how to paddle. And so what are some of the challenges to get more people on the rivers?
Yeah, of course, that in itself is a challenge. Yes, we want more people on the rivers, but we want them to use it responsibly. I've paddled rivers. I tried, quite honestly, to avoid the weekends because that's when more people are on the rivers. So for me, to see wildlife and to do the kinds of things that I need to do, I need to be quiet as I go along the way. I see lots and lots of more things than most people do as a result of paddling alone and being pretty quiet except for my little digital recording along the way. I think the challenge is to get people on the river, but to use it responsibly. Because it is such an important wildlife habitat, that habitat has to be there for wildlife, and we have to realize that we're visitors. We've used and abused our rivers ever since we settled in Iowa. Our ancestors from Euro-Americans that came here and began to settle Iowa in the European tradition, not in the Native American tradition, but in the European tradition where we put towns and roads and that sort of thing. Lots of the towns that were established were on rivers because rivers gave them power, it gave them transportation, it gave them a place to throw stuff away. And so we've used rivers, used them in the worst sense of the word, for many, many decades now, ever since the 1830s, as conduits of trash. And they're sort of like open sewers. Now, we've cleaned a lot of that up since the 1950s, which has really been wonderful to see. We've got more wildlife species than we had before. Growing up in southeastern Iowa, I never saw a wild turkey or a trumpeter swan or even very many bald eagles, except in the wintertime, and then it was only adults. But now we see them all over the place, and that's because people cared enough to clean up our rivers, to clean up our environment, to ban DDT. We made some tough decisions as a society, but they were the right decisions to make. And I hope we do the same then with our rivers. That's the other challenge. We want people out there to use it responsibly, but also then the people, the landowners along the way, have to see that river not as something to use, but as this organism, as a living organism with whom we share the landscape. So we have to be much more careful about getting our water clean before we're dumping it through tile lines directly into rivers and streams. We need to figure out ways to clean up that water, to make sure that the very high nutrient loads that have been going into the Gulf of Mexico and causing a hypoxia crisis down there, there's destroying whole human industries down there and fisheries. We need to get those under control. We need to take it seriously and not be political about them. Just say, look, this is a problem we have as a society. We know this. We need to solve it. And I think if we think creatively, we can do that. But we tend to be thinking more politically, unfortunately.
I agree. The environment does not need to be a political discussion. And I love how you compared it to the bald eagle. I always talk about how society came together and made the right decision. And now we have a beautifully recovered bald eagle population in the state. And I also see that happening with the monarch butterfly.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to see all these different diverse groups on all sides of the political spectrum coming together to save the monarch butterfly because, you know, water is so important to Iowa. The monarch butterfly is so important here. Bald eagles are so important here. And these can be conduits for people to come together and to work together. And so that's, I think, important for conservationists to remember, too, is to celebrate those successes.
Because absolutely.
When you look at
absolutely.
The big picture, sometimes you can feel overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And I think the public sometimes feels overwhelmed when they look at the big picture. So think about the bald eagle. Think about the monarch butterfly. Think about what we can do with our rivers and rally around those success stories and potential success stories, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, Jesse. And I think that if we choose the right path as a society, it's not easy. It's not easy to do. I mean, that decision on DDT back in 1973 was a long time coming, very divisive issue within society. But as a society, we made that decision, even tough as it was. And look what's happened. Not only bald eagles, peregrine falcons, brown and white pelicans, all kinds of things that were impacted by that miracle pesticide that came out of World War II. All of a sudden, we saw that it was a miracle for us, but it wasn't a miracle for other species. And boy, you know, as that, those are not easy decisions. And I think water quality decisions here are the same sorts of things. It's not an easy decision to make, but I think we all know what the right decisions are. We just have to find the mechanism to make it possible.
Jim, tell us some stories about the 1,800 miles of paddling. Tell us about the animals that you've seen.
It's been just absolutely delightful to put my kayak in the water in the early morning. My wife and I have been able to camp in lots of state and county parks all over the state as a result of this, because we'll spend a week or so paddling a certain section of a river, or sometimes more than that. And so we get to camp, and it's been wonderful. We're still tent campers, so we do get up in the morning and make our own meals and get out there on the river. And I think one of the most exciting things for me has been seeing critters in surprising places, in surprising numbers sometimes. One comes to mind, and that's the great horned owl. I expected, if you'd have said to me, what owls do you think you'll see? Well, I'd say, well, we'll see a lot of barred owls along the river. So I expected to see them because they're very common in Iowa. They're our most aquatic species. They will take, they'll even wade in shallow water and take small fish and crayfish. You'll find sometimes barred owl pellets that have crayfish exoskeletons in them. So I expected to see a lot of barred owls. And I thought I would see some great horns, but I saw so many great horned owls, and they often came up from just a few feet off the water on the banks of the river. And it really surprised me and puzzled me for a long time. In fact, I began to think, I put a little article in the one of the statewide newsletters about this, asking other paddlers to report any sightings that they had. I think one of the reasons I saw a lot is because I was a solo paddler. I'm paddling quietly. But these great horned owls were coming off the bank, and at first I thought they were maybe even nesting there, because I'd often see three in a row, and they'd be one adult and two little ones. So I thought, maybe they're nesting. And where a tree will sometimes fall either into the water or into the woodlands off the bank, it leaves often a cavity in that bank. And so I thought, maybe they're nesting in there. And I've only found a couple of places where I thought they were quite possibly nesting, but I haven't been able to prove it. But the more I saw, and I was seeing as many as one per every 2 miles after I'd paddled several hundreds of miles of rivers, and I'm thinking, wow, that's a lot of great horned owls, you know? And I was thinking, the more I watched them, the more I realized once they flew up, they would immediately be harassed by blue jays and Baltimore Orioles and crows. And I think they roost on the banks because to avoid harassment. I think that's what it comes down to, that they don't get harassed by the other birds. So it's like, oh, that's a good, safe place to be. So I think that's largely what they're doing there. But, and this is something we learn about wildlife, we don't know everything about them. And I think they may be more aquatic than we've thought they were in the past. We've always thought that we've known that they take large mammals, rabbits, even skunks, that sort of thing. But maybe great horned owls take some aquatic wildlife too that we hadn't thought about. So it's interesting.
That's an amazing story. And thanks so much for the work that you do.
Oh, my pleasure.
And so much knowledge has been gained and will be gained by the work that you do over the years. Tell us, Jim, where we should go to find out more information about Iowa River Survival and the Water Trails Program.
Okay. Yeah, Iowa Rivers Revival, if you Google that, it's such a wonderful verb. If you put that in your computer and your search engine and look for Iowa Rivers Revival, that's a great source of information. Some of the listeners might want to become involved in the Master River Steward Program, which is an 8-week-long program that I helped get started through Iowa Rivers Revival, and it's now going out all over the state. There are lots of training sessions going on. There were three this past year, three different counties sponsoring them. So you can go online for that, and I think it's iowarivers.org, but I haven't thought of that. I should have thought of that this morning. But the other one then with the Water Trails Program, if you go to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources website and type in Water Trails under their search engine, you'll come to the Water Trails Program. There were now 6 brand new brochures out for 6 of the designated water trails in Iowa, and it's a great program. They're removing a lot of dams, dangerous, no longer functioning dams on Iowa rivers, allowing those rivers to reconnect with places upstream. So it's a really important program, both of them. And I think that's the best way probably is just to get online and type in either one of those.
Thank you so much, Jim, for being a champion for wildlife and being such a great partner to Blake Park Zoo.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us today. And if you want to learn more about Blank Park Zoo, head over to our website, blankparkzoo.com. There's a huge section of conservation materials. Also, you can find out about our events and our animals and all the fun stuff at Blank Park Zoo. Again, that's blankparkzoo.com. Well, that's all the time we have for today, so join us next time for Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.